Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, I'm Rachel Hampton.
And I'm Candace Lim, and you're listening to ICYMI.
In case you missed it,
Slate's podcast about internet culture.
And Candace, I have an investigative journalist question for you, which is, what was it like to write the anonymous Pace magazine review of Taylor Swift's latest album, Tortured Poets Department?
First off, it was albums, two S's, and no, Swifties, put the Twitter down. I promise you, I did not write the anonymous review, let alone any review, because I have not listened to the Tortured Poets Department plus the anthology, and I don't think I will. Look, I just feel like we are indeed living in the depths of, like, Taylor state media, meaning you just can't get away from her. And so my hot take is that I am at a place in my life where I constantly have to ask myself, is Taylor's new album more important than what is going on in my life? And I have to say, this weekend, the answer was no. I have other things to do. So, Taylor, I will see you when you win your fifth album of the year.
You know what? That is so smart to prioritize yourself. But it does make me want to ask, what are those other things? What did you get up to this weekend, Candace?
Ooh, okay. So while the girls were at Coachella, I was at a Coachella of sorts called the LA Times Festival of Books.
Same thing. Exact same thing.
So this is an annual two-day festival held at USC, and it's like booksellers, authors, Taheen, The Spice was also there, and they just pop up. They talk about books. They play games. It's really fun. I was a volunteer, so I basically stood at a door, and I told people where the bathroom was, and that was actually very fun. It kind of invigorated my, like, service arm a bit, so I'm really happy I went, and I still have, like, FOMO, which is kind of funny.
Wait, so as the Coachella of books, who were the big names there? Who was headlining?
Okay, so headliners were RuPaul, Kerry Washington, the Pod Save America Boys. John Green was also there.
Okay, Fault in Our Stars.
I gotta say, I don't go for the headliners. I go for my girls out at the Pepsi Cola stage, okay? Because I have two highlights, highlights. First, Helen Mirren. You know her?
Yes. Of course I know Helen Mirren. She wrote a book?
So Helen Mirren randomly showed up. I don't think it was announced. I think she was there because her husband was, like, on a panel to talk about the new, like, Blood In, Blood Out book. But she was, like, backstage just chilling. And she took a photo with Valentina, the drag queen. It's on Twitter. Oh, and it's very cute. God. It's very cute. But here's the thing.
What's the thing?
I'm not going to say Helen is not a big deal, but I would say my own personal Helen Mirren, DJ James Kennedy was there.
Oh, my God.
Uh-huh.
No, my, not DJ James Kennedy. What? Does he even read? Why is he at the Festival of Books?
So I asked the same question because DJ James Kennedy of Vanderpump Rules was there with his girlfriend, Allie. And I was like, oh, maybe they're here to support Ariana Maddox because she was doing this huge Q&A. But the thing is, her panel was on Sunday and they were there on Saturday. And so I found out that James and Allie were apparently performing a song at the children's stage.
Okay.
Yep.
Fascinating. Yep. A mental image I can't quite evoke.
Exactly. And so, yeah, I would say my highlights were Helen Mirren, James Kennedy, all in all, had a great time. Go books!
Go books! We love literacy.
Yeah. Rachel, what did you get up to this weekend?
So I was also making myself literate sort of this weekend. And by making myself literate, I mean I decided to watch Frasier from the beginning.
Wow.
This was not my first time viewing Frasier. My mom actually loves Frasier, so I have seen a lot of episodes in the background of my youth. However, I've never watched it as an adult with like a kind of fully formed self-awareness. And let me tell you, most of those jokes went right over 14-year-old Rachel's head. I did not understand just how insufferable Frasier was as a character.
Yeah.
But watching it now is so funny. It's weirdly timely, and also it feels more like a media show than I think I really fully understood, because Frasier works as a host of a radio show. So I'm a little bit just like, ooh, if I was a 41-year-old white man in Seattle in 1993, I might be Frasier. Probably not. But like, just saying, I understand like the milieu that he is around.
Wow. That's really evocative.
Thank you.
I would also say, I wonder if Frasier hits you different now, because we don't really have a good media show or like a good media film, right? Like, we didn't really grow up at the right time for The Newsroom, starring Dev Patel, of course.
Of course.
We didn't grow up at the time of like news radio. We don't really have a definitive thing.
No, I think the closest was The Bold Type. And honestly, I did not watch that.
Yeah, see, and that's, we both know that's so unrealistic, especially when all of the magazines they mentioned literally don't exist anymore.
Yeah, so if you want a picture of a healthy and thriving media economy, go watch Frasier, because it no longer exists now. Woo!
That's so funny. But that is a good show that I'm glad you got into, because there are so many episodes that'll last you a while. Could I throw in one more thing I watched this weekend?
Of course.
Baby Reindeer on Netflix. Have you heard about this?
No. It's April. What's going on?
It is April.
Is this a Christmas show?
So I'm not surprised, because I too did not hear about this. It was so low key, but this is basically a miniseries by Richard Gadd, and it is about a young comedian in London who gets stalked by an older woman. And at first you think it's going to be like kind of a comedy of sorts, but very quickly you realize that this is a very dark and serious show, because it is based on Richard Gadd's life. Like, he was actually stalked. And it's kind of about these 6 months and the psychological and emotional toll of him being stalked, and how like shame and self-blame was a very big reason why he didn't talk about it, why men who are stalked and harassed do not come forward. I was very blown away by this show, because not only is it very Black Mirror of like, look what technology has done to us, but I genuinely think this might be one of the most important shows of this year. I think it's the I May Destroy You of this year. So if you guys are in the right headspace, really recommend Baby Reindeer.
Okay, I will definitely add that to my list. I do have to admit that I never watched I May Destroy You, just because everyone told me that you have to be in the right headspace, and I have not been in the right headspace since the fall of 2021. So,
hey, that's very real. That's very real. So, all 7 episodes out on Netflix, Baby Reindeer. That's what I'm into. But let's get into today's show, because is this true, Rachel? You had a very fascinating conversation about Roblox?
Yes, yes, we were talking about babies of a sort, not baby reindeer, but baby humans, who apparently love something called Roblox. This is, I think, my most boomer topic, because I don't understand what's going on. I am the person who's out here saying, what is a Roblox? What is a Robux? And thankfully, on today's episode, someone was answering those questions, and that someone is writer Steffi Cao, who has written for The Atlantic, Teen Vogue, BuzzFeed, Fast Company, and she wrote a great piece about Roblox's new $35 million fund for creators. Did I even know there were creators on Roblox? I'm not going to answer that question, but I will be back with Steffi after a short break. Hi, Hi, y'all. If you love our podcast, then please consider subscribing to Slate Plus. When you subscribe to Slate Plus, you get no ads on any Slate podcasts. You will also be supporting the show. ICYMI would not be possible without the support of Slate Plus subscribers. You will also get bonus segments or episodes on shows like Slow Burn, Political Gap Fest, Working, and Amicus, which you will definitely need as we go into Supreme Court season. With a Slate Plus subscription, you also get unlimited reading on the Slate website, which means you get access to every single article and advice column on Slate without ever hitting the paywall. To sign up, just visit slate.com/ICYMI+. That is slate.com/ICYMI+.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Let's face it, sometimes multitasking can be overwhelming, like when your favorite podcast is playing and the person next to you is talking and your car fan is blasting, all while you're trying to find the perfect parking spot. But then again, sometimes multitasking is easy, like quoting with Progressive Insurance. They do the hard work of comparing rates so you can find a great rate that works for you, even if it's not with them. Give their nifty comparison tool a try, and you might just find getting the rate and coverage you deserve is easy. All you need to do is visit Progressive's website to get a quote with all the coverages you want, like comprehensive and collision coverage or personal injury protection. Then you'll see Progressive's direct rate, and their tool will provide options from other companies all lined up and ready to compare, so it's simple to choose the rate and coverages you like. Press play on comparing auto rates. Quote at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Did you know that 35% of adults report experiencing poor sleep quality? Discover the secret to better sleep with Cozy Earth's luxurious bedding products. And boy, are they luxurious. From the moment I took my Cozy Earth sheets out of their packaging, it came in a very cute little canvas tote bag, by the way. Phenomenal packaging. What was even more phenomenal is how soft these sheets are. I touched them and then I made my roommate touch them to confirm to me that they were this soft. And sleeping in them is like sleeping in a cloud. Cozy Earth bedding products are crafted with temperature regulating technology, adapting to your body's needs, ensuring a sleep experience tailored to you. They use only the very best fabrics, materials, and weaves, offering superior softness that invites you to sink into a world of comfort. Enjoy a 100-night sleep trial and a 10-year warranty on all purchases. That is a decade of unparalleled comfort and support. Incorporating Cozy Earth products into your self-care routine can enhance your sleep quality and overall wellness. Treat yourself to ultimate comfort with Cozy Earth bedding and sleepwear and prioritize your self-care and sleep health. Head over to CozyEarth.com and use promo code online for an exclusive 35% off. Upgrade your nights, transform your days with Cozy Earth. And we're back with Steffi Cao, a culture writer whose work has appeared in The Atlantic, Teen Vogue, CNN, BuzzFeed, Forbes, and Fast Company. It is for that last publication that she wrote an article titled, Roblox Launched a $35 Million Fund for Creators and Introduces Its Answer to TikTok. I have so many questions, but before we get into them, welcome to ICYMI, Steffi.
Thank you so much for having me, Rachel. I'm so excited to chat.
I'm so excited you're here. As a first-time guest, I have to ask, what is your first internet memory?
My first internet memory is watching the Potter Puppet Pals like YouTube videos around the after-school daycare. Like, you know, when your parents work 9 to 5, so you had like Latchkey Club gathered around the computer. And I was like 6 years old, maybe.
That is beautiful. I still, even you just mentioning that made the song start playing in my head of like Ron Weasley. Yep. So you really, you brought me back.
It's a great memory.
It's so true. It's so true. It can't be ruined by that lady. Mm-mm. So your piece really caught my attention, not least because Roblox is one of those internet black boxes for me. Like, all I know is that it's for children, it costs money, and that back in October, children were coordinating protests in solidarity with Palestine on Roblox, which is one of the few things that made me say out loud, I believe the children are the future. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of parents and educators who listen to our show, so this might be one of the times where the audience knows more than me. I'm still going to ask the dumb question, though. What is Roblox?
I mean, this is one of those things where if you know, you know, and if you really don't, you don't. But Roblox basically is a server, like a game server. So it relies on user-created games, and so you can bounce from game to game. It is primarily through your avatar, which you design and everyone recognizes from like the blocky little heads. But yeah, that's basically really what it is. And you can create any kind of game, but obviously some of them get really, really big. And the money comes in when you create like skins for your, you know, your block guy, or you can sell things through your game, like in-app purchases, basically. But yeah, it's basically a server. And so a lot of those games, you know, they can be very challenge-based or they can be very world-based. And that's where things like the protests were taking place. It was in a very just like world-built game.
The kind of closest corollary that comes to mind when I start to understand Roblox is like The Sims or maybe even GeoCities, which I think both formed the first internet memories of a lot of people. And they were unique in that I'd say their primary function was hosting content that was created by users. In the case of GeoCities, that content was websites. With Sims, it was fucked up families created by preteen girls in their free time after school. But would you say that those are kind of accurate comparisons for understanding Roblox if you've never gone to, is it Roblox.com?
Yeah, I would say like The Sims is a pretty good comparison. Like it really is just like a general network more so. I would say like think of it as like a nebulous where you can like enter different worlds and kind of switch in between them. So it is, part of it is Sims. And then a part of it is like, you know, the challenges within Sims that you can kind of play, like things like that. It is world building, but there's also very almost Minecraft based games like Temple Run kind of game. So it can be really anything, but it is basically this huge server.
Yeah. Yeah. You said a nebulous?
Yeah. I consider it a nebulous when I like look at it. It feels very much like a cloud. Mm-hmm. And its success depends a lot on the users and what they create from it. And so, you know, it can be nothing, but because these creators have been able to take things so far and create all different kinds of games and really expand the world, I think, you know, it's become this phenomenon that would not have happened without its users.
That makes a lot of sense. That's a lot of kind of platform-based apps. I mean, Twitter, Tumblr, TikTok, where it almost entirely depends on the user base creating something. So according to my extensive notes, Roblox launched in 2006. I only started hearing about it in like 2020. So I really kind of associated it with the pandemic. Would you say that's kind of like an accurate timeline for when it started popping off?
Yeah, I would say so. I think definitely when kids were shut inside and especially during lockdown, that's when the boom really started to happen of like so many kids were getting on Roblox and being able to hang out as almost like a third space with each other. And a lot of the coverage that we see about Roblox traces back to that time in 2020.
Yeah, yeah. What would you say? I mean, I feel like there's always concerns whenever there's an app that's primarily used by children. Are there similar concerns with Roblox or is it like, I feel like Club Penguin was pretty safe, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I would say there has been a huge issue with Roblox over the years, which is why the story was so interesting to see the Creator Fund launched. Mm. Because over time, there has been a lot of backlash that the company has faced for essentially profiting off of what is child labor. And it's a big question of like, is this ethical? Is this not? Is this legal? Is this not? Because these kids are willingly creating games and who is seeing the money off of it? It is Roblox. So I think it is interesting to see when they set up the initial game fund, which was like a $25 million like pot for anyone who wanted to create a Roblox game specifically. I feel in response, and what the reporting shows in response to the sort of like criticism they've been facing over not paying the children that were powering their platform. And so now looking at, you know, they're expanding this and they're moving it beyond just people who want to design games, but really any sort of like appy based thing, it really is almost a continuation of that conversation of the nebulous expanding.
And according to your piece in Fast Company, Roblox has around 71 million daily active users as of March. Do you get the sense that the platform is still growing, or do you feel like the children have maybe moved on to something cooler?
I definitely think that when it comes to Roblox, what I found in my reporting and speaking to the company, it seems that they are interested in expanding beyond children. They're trying to look beyond just the age group and also to people who are over the age of 18. I don't know what will happen next as a group ages up. You know, there's always big changes that happen to a company then. But I definitely can say that the platform seems interested in expanding beyond the idea they are just for children. You can see a couple years ago, they mentioned they wanted to almost expand Roblox into like a dating aspect, almost like a Tinder for, you know, people in college and above. And that seems like, you know, very much like an older person's game. So are they meeting their younger audience as they grow up? Who knows? But it definitely seems they want to expand beyond, you know, this is the kids' game.
So I feel like I keep saying children, and a lot of them definitely use Roblox. It is apparently the most popular game with 5 to 12-year-olds in the U.S. And as you were saying, that's raised questions around exploitation of minors, right? Which makes sense when you have a platform where all the content is user-created and all the users are children. Yeah. So tell me a little bit more about those kind of concerns around, like, child labor.
Well, this is not really just a Roblox thing, but also an internet-wide thing, is more users are powering, you know, these platforms. It's become an issue as clearly these platforms are profiting and making huge money. And with things like TikTok, you know, the answer for Instagram, for TikTok, for now, I guess, X a little bit, the answer has been pots of money for the people making it. An answer to these videos are going viral. These kids are like 16, 15, younger and younger and younger, making this content for free. That is then generating lots and lots of income for tech executives. So Roblox is definitely not immune to the accusations, especially with its audience base being so young, of, are you exploiting children? It's just something we have to figure out, right? Like, if what is the line between a user creating it and also the ethics of allowing children to create things in a space while allowing them to be creative and letting them to build worlds. And as we can see on Roblox, so many big movements, especially, you know, like the pro-Palestine marches that happened in November, this is a huge space for them to express themselves, to connect with each other. And will tamping down on that business aspect also limit them from creating? I think there's like a conversation to be had there. But definitely, as it stands, if someone's making money, that means, and someone's doing free labor, I think the arrows point towards a pretty specific conclusion as it stands right now. So I think the Creator Fund, as a reporter, any app creating Creator Fund is always an answer, I think, to those kinds of accusations.
And that makes a lot of sense, especially considering, as you wrote in your piece, Roblox reported that creators earned $741 million on the platform in 2023. I have two questions about that. One is, we haven't actually gotten into how do people make money off of Roblox. I've heard of something called Robux.
There are Robux, yes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So there are lots of ways to make money on Roblox, not just the Creator Fund, which is almost like a project-based process where they accept applicants on a project base. So one of those projects being what they're calling Clip It, which is effectively their answer to TikTok. So that's like one of the projects they offered as like an example of what kind of projects they're looking for when it comes to the Roblox Creator Fund. That's a finite amount of money, and there's a finite amount of people accepted. But in the wider nebulous of Roblox, there's also like the Robux, which is like your more or less like Club Penguin coins or any in-game coins, but there is like a market of like clothes you can buy and sell, and certain creators have made a lot of money like buying and selling clothes and, you know, any sort of like small trinkets for your avatar. That's a huge earner for some people, and it has been accused of like micro consumerism or something, where basically it's like, is it scammy that like you're selling like a 50 cent earring for your Roblox character? Like it's almost like the ethics of penny trading, like what mm-hmm. what is this really? So that's like a huge part of it. Also, like a lot of in-game app purchases, like any other game, like Candy Crush, you know, unlock another life or whatever, things like that. It's all part of how you make money on Roblox.
So I guess following up on that, according to a statement given to you by the company, the majority of those people making money, the majority of the people making that $741 million on the platform are over the age of 18. Do you believe that?
I mean, it's hard to say, right? Like, if you ask any company, and you know as a reporter, like, how transparent they're going to be, they're going to tell you what they want to tell you. And so what we've seen come out of it is that, like, I'm sure legally there are probably a lot of contingencies around, like, paying young people, because then you're really engaging yeah. specifically in, like, child labor laws, and you're held accountable to all of that. So what we see from other industries and from the internet economy at large is that, yeah, most people making money are like people over the age of 18, because one, I would imagine it's a lot easier to deal with legally to pay out yeah. someone who's over the age of 18. And also, like, with income, and when it comes to like big time creators, like if you're dealing with someone under the age of 18, there's just a lot more that mm-hmm. goes into it. So yeah, I believe it. But that leaves a question of, so what about the kids who are under the age yeah. of 18 and the things they're making, not just for Roblox, but for, you know, for TikTok and Twitter and Wattpad and all these apps that really rely on minor engagement. And there is so much community and so much content being generated there. What about that? What happens next?
Yeah, that's such a good point. I mean, it makes me think that that figure that they're giving you, which is $714 million, is basically just kind of scraping the top of the money that could be made off of Roblox if most of the games being created are not by people under the age of 18. It's like, oh, that's just the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, it's always curious to, obviously this piece is very much just a straight report on what happened and the launch of the Creator Fund, and it's not necessarily an explosive investigation, but as an internet culture reporter, I think it's interesting to note these little things when they arise as a part of like the context in this fabric of this growing, booming industry.
Mm-hmm. And I want to get a little more detail about the launch of the Creator Fund and your write-up about it. We'll get into all of that and more after a short break.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Sibling fights are unavoidable, but what if every fight you had was under a microscope on a global scale? That's the reality for brothers Prince William and Prince Harry. They were each other's closest friends and allies since the death of their mother, but that all began to crack as they married and took wildly different approaches to their royal duties. Wondery's podcast, Dis and Tell, is hosted by comedians Sydney Battle and Matt Bellassai. Each episode unpacks one of pop culture's most iconic celebrity feuds, and they recently took a deeper look into the real reason William versus Harry started. It's actually much bigger than these two brothers, stretching back into the history of the British monarchy. Did their feud start with the royal family's mistreatment of Meghan Markle, or was it something that started much earlier? Follow Dis and Tell on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts.
The new Starz series, Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true. But shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son, George, on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. Trust me, you've never seen a mother-son duo like this before. The show is full of wit, scandal, action, and did I mention Julianne Moore? Something this audacious and sexy as is genre-bending as it gets. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Stars and the Stars app.
And we're back. So before the break, Steffi, you were talking about how it's kind of important to note the launch of the Creator Fund in the context of this billion-dollar industry that is social media. And I think that's a perfect segue into the $35 million Creator Fund that you wrote about. In your piece, you wrote, while the company previously offered a fund for games makers and designers, the expanded $35 million fund will encompass developer studios and users who want to build things beyond games on the server. And one of the first partners is a short-form video service nudging into the social media landscape. Now, I have basic English comprehension, so I understand this sentence, but like practically, what does this mean for creators on Roblox? Like, have you seen this short form video service? What's going on?
Well, what it seems like, sort of writing the piece, is that Roblox is interested in expanding beyond just being known as a game. It seems that they also want these off-platform things, which they have been trying to do for much longer than just this year, of becoming a much bigger entity of technology. So they have the game portion, and they have basically what is like a Reels or a TikTok, something short form. If they launch something that is dating-based, they have that. They also have previously looked into sort of like a YouTube / Twitch live streaming portion of their platform. So for creators, it means that there could be a lot more opportunity to get onto Roblox and start making money in different ways, in not just designing games, but, you know, really focusing on building one of these platforms that eventually makes Roblox a much bigger cloud than it is right now, which is already huge, but yeah.
It sounds a lot like the old TikTok Creators Fund, where there's like a set amount of money and then it gets distributed, versus what happens on TikTok now, which is basically kind of like a revenue sharing based on view count. Is that accurate?
Yes. As of right now, it is a set amount, and there are varying grants almost that you get if you're accepted into the Creators Fund, depending on what the project is, how long it is, things like that. So all of their details on how to apply for the fund are on their site and things like that. And I also wrote them through in the piece.
So basically, if I were to sign up for my little free Roblox account and I was like, I want to make a game that is Twilight, basically. And Roblox was like, we like that. And then they just partner with you. Do they give like help to the video game developers, or is it just like, here's $5,000, keep doing your Twilight game?
This is what I think is interesting about this game fund as opposed to like other platforms, is the other social media platforms, it's much more simple. It is like money per view, money per follower. This RevShare really is almost like a grant, like a research grant, where you do work with the Roblox studios. You get advice, and you know, you're part of like a much bigger hemisphere, and like in terms of getting guidance, some of them are often like smaller studios that need like maybe like a bigger corporate hand in building whatever they need to build. So it, and it's not just like a Twilight game anymore. It could be like, oh, I want to build like bunch of AR filters that turn you into like a wolf or so, whatever. Or I want to build basically like a Pinterest function where you can pin a bunch of smutty Jacob and Edward fanfic to the wall. Like that, those are things are now possible with the Creator Fund, which weren't previously available with the Game Fund, which is really just focused on building games. Me as a person, I do think that there is an interest in having more guidance in the Roblox fund, because their audience is a lot younger, but also their product is a lot more involved than like posting a straight TikTok or just posting on Instagram.
Yeah, that's such a good point. I wonder almost, do you think that's something that should be, I guess it's kind of a broader question. Do you think that kind of hands-on guidance is something that other like social media platforms should take notes from?
This is my thing about like social media is that there are a lot of like resources. I think the one thing that I hear a lot from parents is they're afraid on the internet. They're afraid when their child goes on and starts navigating the web that there is some like weirdo lurking in the shadows, like with their claws waiting to like grasp out and like drain their like credit cards via their kid or something. I don't know. And obviously there are a lot of issues and dangers and real problems, especially systemically and technologically online. But at the same time, like, let's be so real, the internet is a lot safer than it was when you and I were coming up. Like, there was no like YouTube parental guidelines at that point. Like, you could do whatever, like on Tumblr, you could be looking up anything in the world and it would come up. And now there are so many more guidelines and, you know, structures because this is a real industry now and companies have to be held accountable to a certain degree for their actions. And so I think that it is interesting in that, like, should companies be more hands-on with creators? I don't know where I stand on that because I do think in some ways there is a lot of support and a lot of especially guidelines for children, more so than there was before. But it obviously is like still a persisting problem, but in my opinion, these are like problems of like pedophilia, of racism, of hate crimes existed before the internet. And what we're seeing is not an internet problem. It's a people problem.
Mm-hmm. That's like such a good point. It's, the internet has given more like ability and more anonymity, but the actual problems are ones that existed before the kind of influx of technology.
Yeah, I just think there's such beauty in a space that allows young kids to be able to create the things they want to create, especially when they have limited agency, and being able to see them build things. Like, of course, yeah, kids are going to be evil a little bit, and you know, and they're going to be kind of jerks and they're gonna be annoying. They're always gonna be annoying. That's a truth that will exist long after we are dead. But where else could children organize for against the Palestinian genocide and speak up and find each other in that space? Where else could they do that? And so I think there is such a wonderful thing in letting, you know, your kid just kind of go ape online, because it's also where they find, you know, it's such formation of identity, and to be able to do something like that is very impressive.
That's such a good point. I feel like I, as I get older, I keep finding myself in this kind of catch-22 of, I'm actually so glad I had very little parental supervision on the internet when I was coming up, and then simultaneously being an adult on the internet and being like, maybe there should be separate spaces for adults. Yes. And children, you know? And Roblox seems perhaps like one that is mostly for children. Maybe good.
As of right now, it's where it stands, is their fan base or their user base is predominantly underage. So it'll be interesting to see how, you know, it's still a corporation and the corporation wants to maximize audience and market and, you know, profit ultimately. So it'll be interesting to see what comes of this, especially the Creator Fund, its whole rebrand, and especially if they're opening up to other products, basically, or, you know, users coding for them, essentially, and building things for them, what happens then? But yeah, I always think about, like, how formative it was to, you know, write the most unhinged fan fiction that you've ever seen in your life. You know, it was such a, mm-hmm. and find community from that, and, you know, reblog a bunch of GIFs and see the people who were also, like, you know, in those same fan bases as you. I think that was such a wonderful formative thing. And, you know, obviously people like to focus a lot on the negative parts and the dangerous parts of the internet for very good reason. But I do think that it's important to note that a lot of these things are just a mirror of what exists in our society and the power imbalances and, you know, the struggles and the real like prejudices and hate that exists in our society prior to this tool.
One of the things I find most interesting about Roblox is kind of how like self-contained their content is. Like if you don't have a TikTok, you'll still encounter TikToks just by being on the internet. But as you can probably tell by the questions I've been asking, it's pretty easy to not encounter Roblox content if you're not looking for it. Do you think that's kind of a strength of the platform? Or do you think this creator fund is partially to make Roblox more of a household name for people without children?
From my point of view, as like a reporter and, you know, as people who are watching the internet, seeing these companies get bigger, it does feel like the latter more so, where it does feel like a company trying to become more ubiquitous in the space beyond just its siloed portion of the internet. So we'll see, obviously, with things like Twitch, where it previously was really siloed, and its attempt to become more corporate, more sponsor friendly, that's then inspired a lot of frustration and debate between its creators and the company, you know, with people leaving for Kick and things like that, and how that all plays out. I think this feels reminiscent, and not completely, but it does feel like a similar kind of growth in that way.
How do you think the kind of user base of Roblox is going to respond to this attempt to grow?
I don't know if this is the thing, is that I feel like I can offer my analysis, but we really got to ask the 10-year-olds. And I feel like the 10-year-olds are like not really thinking about it, honestly. I feel like this is like one of those weird stories where it's like it's kind of above their heads. I definitely think as it gets bigger, I think there is a 10-year-old instinct to just want to make slime of everything, to mix things and use things. I also think that's why the drunk elephant bronzing drop thing is so popular among 10-year-olds. I don't think parents should be freaking out about it, because I think what it is 10-year-olds trying to appease that desire to make slime of everything. I think it'll be interesting to see when the tools come up, how these kids make slime of it.
Yeah. I love that. If we have any 10-year-olds listening to us, or parents of 10-year-olds, please offer your children to us to be interviewed on air.
Yes, please, like, tweet me. I'm just, for personal reasons, I'm curious. Like, tweet me, Instagram DM me. I'm so curious.
All right, that's the show. We'll be back in your feed on Saturday, so definitely subscribe. That's the best way to never miss an episode. Please leave a 5-star rating and review in Apple or Spotify, and tell your friends about us. You can follow us on Twitter at @icymi_pod, and you can always drop us a note at icymi@slate.com.
ICYMI is produced by Sierra Spragley-Ricks, Rachel Hampton, and me, Candace Lim. Daisy Rosario is our senior supervising producer, and Alicia Montgomery is Slate's vice president of audio. See you online.
Or on Roblox.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.